Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening, good evening. Nice to see you all. Nice to be here. I love coming to visit in this Zendo. Lots of practice in this room over many years. Lots of Zendos around the country are converted barns, converted garages, converted houses. So this is a special Zendo built. Yesterday morning, I had a delightful and unusual experience. I gave a brief talk, part of a panel of the Elijah Interfaith Institute, which is an international interfaith group that I think has its headquarters in Jerusalem. They mostly operate in Europe, Asia. And I participate with them from time to time, not very often because it's too far to go all that way. But sometimes if they haven't been online and they invite me, I come. It represents all religions, Hindu, Sikh, Muslim, Christian, Jewish, a few Buddhists, not too many. This panel discussion, the subject was saints. That was a subject aside. And so I listened to everybody's talks, and they were really interesting, very brief talks. One Hindu guy with a big, long, white beard said that saints are different from other spiritual teachers because what they offer is not teaching or even moral exemplar, but a direct connection to God. And that's what they manifest and they express in their living. And that's the source of their power and inspiration. That's what he said. And then he talked about a saint that he knew, that he had studied with, and how inspired he was by this person, and how even though the person was deceased now, he felt like he was with him every day. The Muslim cleric talked about a saint who was also his teacher and also his father. And then he proceeded to talk in very learned detail, which I confess I couldn't entirely follow, about three teachings that he learned from his father. And his talk was very philosophical and careful. The rabbi talked about the famous 18th century rabbi from Ukraine, known as the Baal Shem Tov, and he was the founder of Hasidism. The Baal Shem taught that the whole world is filled with God's glory. That's a line from a Jewish prayer. The whole world is filled with God's glory. And this rabbi who was explaining about this was very enthusiastic and joyful as he gave this talk about this. And he said that that line means that everything is God. Everything you look at, everywhere you look, it's only God. And furthermore, that God is new and fresh every moment. The world is born, you know, fresh and new every day. So our practice should always be fresh and new every day, he said. And he was very enthusiastic as he said about this. The Catholic Monsignor was also an Indian guy, who said that he had been a stockbroker, but he gave that up to become a Catholic priest. And his example of a saint was Mother Teresa, whom he had met a few times And he said that she was really, really impactful on his life. And she said that he said that she, Mother Teresa, gave him the five-finger gospel. And the five-finger gospel, he said, was his main practice. And then he held up his hand, which was not a hand, because, he explained to us, he was a thalidomide baby. Some of you maybe know what that is. There's a drug that women took many years ago, and it affected the children that they gave birth to. And so he was a thalidomide baby, and he only had one hand. But the stump of the hand that he was holding up, you could see, had five little kind of stumps of fingers on it. And the five-finger gospel, he told us, and Mother Teresa taught him this by touching each of the five fingers on his non-hand. It was a quote from the Gospels, Jesus saying, "I gave this to you." That was the five-finger gospel. He told us that means to him that God gives us our suffering out of love. And so our suffering is to be cherished. And if we face suffering with love and gratitude, this is the greatest practice of all. And he said that's why Mother Teresa loved the poor, because in their suffering she saw gratitude and love. And that's why serving the poor was no sacrifice, but it was a great joy. And he also, that was his work too. So I was really impressed. Aren't these impressive teachings, you know? I was really impressed by that. And every time I go to the Elijah Interfaith, I'm always amazed by the teachings that they give. And then it was my turn, and so I'm gonna share with you the little talk that I gave, very short. So I began by talking about my favorite podcast, which maybe you listen to as well. Ezra Klein has a podcast, and Ezra Klein, not long ago, you heard this one, he was interviewing Brian Stevenson. Brian Stevenson is a very famous, they even made a biopic about him. He's a black lawyer who has spent his entire lifetime defending people on death row who turn out to be disproportionately black Americans. And so he once in a while wins a case, but mostly loses cases. But also, Stevenson founded, I think, more than one museums in Montgomery, Alabama, civil rights museums. And if you ever go to Montgomery, Alabama, or you should go to Montgomery, Alabama, just to see these museums, apparently. I haven't seen them, but I'm going to go. Apparently, they're quite amazing. And So Ezra Klein was seeing these museums, and he said to Brian Stevenson, "How come in this museum about slavery, there's almost no mention at all of the abolitionists? There were lots of famous abolitionists who, you know, went really very courageous to buck the tide and insist on abolition, like, for instance, John Brown, who was eventually killed in the service of the abolition movement. How come the museum doesn't have almost nothing about these people?" And Stevenson said, "Well, it is completely intentional. Because," he said, "the real heroes were not the abolitionists, but the slaves themselves. So the museum is all about the slaves and their lives and individuals among them." Because, he said, "Think about what it takes to have the courage and the endurance to survive with your humanity intact and your wisdom intact in the face of the kind of brutality that these people experienced for more than 200 years. And he pointed out that after emancipation, they did not react with vengeance or disdain, but they tried to cooperate with the very people who had enslaved them. And they tried to engage with them in society. as you know, it didn't work out because the government reneged on its promises for reconstruction, and then the Jim Crow era was instigated. But they were ready to just live side by side with people who had enslaved them and been cruel to them. And Bryan Stevenson thought that was the most saintly and courageous thing. And then I was telling them about a conversation that I remembered that I had had some years ago when I was the abbot at Green Gulch. And it was a conversation that I had with a person who had just come back from Japan, where he had visited a monastery of a very famous Zen master who was famous for his really powerful enlightenment. And I had heard of this Zen master, and I knew that many Western people went to Japan to study with him. And the practice there was famously austere and difficult. And the Westerners who went there were unusually dedicated people, dedicated to this master and to the quest for enlightenment. But after many decades, as far as I was aware, not a single one of them had attained enlightenment. And they never gave up hope, but they lived a very rough life. And I know because I had one friend who had been a priest at the Zen Center with us, and he kind of got fed up at the Zen Center, so he went over there to study with that master, and he actually died an early death because of the lack of sleep and the terrible nutrition. I mean, they barely ate any food, you know, at this monastery. And my friend, you know, just, I think he was in his 50s, and he died. And so the person telling me this story was basically, I was the abbot of the Zen Center, and he was saying, well, you know, that's the real practice. You guys in California, your Zen Center, you really don't know what you're doing. You're just not really doing the practice. It's not so serious, not so dedicated. And he was telling me about this place, and I said, well, you know, what's the use of a great enlightened person if people that he practices with are only suffering and not really benefiting from his enlightenment? What's so great if the ideal is so shiny and so unattainable that it ends up stealing others' joy and delight in just being who they are and doing the practice just as they are with dedication? Is that so great to be following a great enlightened master? And what's the virtue in that? So I told those stories just to say that I have my doubts about Buddhist saints, or any saints for that matter. On the other hand, I think we actually do need people to respect and admire. And we do need examples in the past and also in the present. Because if there are no examples of people that we can admire and look to with faith, then it's sort of like pretty easy to become cynical. Because one looks at oneself and, you know, we're all honest enough to say we're not so enlightened. We're not such great paragons of virtue and courage and wisdom. And then we look at our friends and we see the same thing. And then we look at the newspaper and all the great heroes of the world. And if those are our ideas of goodness and people we're supposed to emulate, I think we're in bad shape. So I think we do need to feel like really being a wise and awakened, a truly good human being is possible. I think we have to believe it's possible, and I think we have to believe it's possible in that we ourselves can strive in that direction. Because I think we need to be idealistic, to be realistic, so-called, is very soon to be cynical or jaded. And that's a sad path in life, you know, to be cynical and jaded. Plenty of evidence to support that point of view. But if that's the point of view that you carry through life, that's sad. That's not a good way to live. Because it wears you out eventually. It wears you down. You get old as a cynical person. It's not a pretty picture. So we do need our religious examples. I wouldn't call them saints exactly, but I think we do need exemplars. So the example that I gave was my own teacher, Sojin Weissman Roshi. He was my first teacher and my Dharma transmission teacher. I met him first in 1970 when I looked up Zen in the Berkeley phone book and went to the Zen Center there, and he showed me how to sit very kindly and said, "You're welcome to come anytime." And in those days, he had just recently started the Berkeley Zen Center, and he remained there. He was abbot of the Berkeley Zen Center for more than 50 years. And he was really steady and dedicated. He was always there. He was always concerned for the life of the temple and of everyone who came to practice there. He was concerned about everyone. And the years went by, and it seemed like, anyway, his concern and care for the temple and for the practice and for the people never seemed to diminish one bit in all the years. I've often told and written about the story of the first time I met him. I went to the Zen Center, and it had two trees in the front yard, a monkey puzzle tree and a yucca tree, and both those trees drop, leaves. Not, they're not even leaves exactly, but spiky things. And so the gardener was in the front yard raking the leaves, and I said, "Is this the Zen Center?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Who's the Roshi at the Zen Center?" And he said, "Well, there's no Roshi here, just the priest." I said, "Okay." And I came back. He said, "This is when there's Asa instruction," and I came back. And when I went there, and it had a very steep attic, really steep, and I walked up the steps to the Zendo, which was in this attic, and the priest was sitting right at the head of the steps, so that you saw the priest's body as you walked up, and I saw the robe, and I saw the, as I went up, more and more of the body came into view, and finally I saw the face, and it was the gardener. It was Mill. He didn't mention that he was the priest when I first saw him. I thought he was the gardener. So he was pretty humble. He stepped down as abbot when he was 91 years old and almost ready to die. He had cancer. And he died on January 7th, 2021, maybe months after he stepped down as abbot. And every year on that date, we have a ceremony honoring him according to tradition. And we're happy to do that ceremony. And he comes back to us every year on that day. And he's with us other days too. And he was, as I say, very humble and not impressive. You know, when I met him, I didn't think anything of it. Very ordinary. And also, knowing him as well as I did know him, he had plenty of human foibles, as anybody does. But the characteristic that I think that he had that was really genius and so admirable was his utter sincerity. He never was never at all in any way manipulative. He was never trying to be charming or important or right. He was just not self-conscious in any way. He was always willing to be just himself as he was, with nothing to prove or uphold And therefore, it kind of gave you permission to be who you were, too. It seems like this quality is not such a big deal. But the truth of the matter is, it's very, very unusual for a human being to be that way. Because we're all always trying to be someone that we think we're supposed to be. Either other people think we're supposed to be, or in our own mind we have an idea of who we're supposed to be, and we're always trying to measure up to that person. To just be willing to be who you are on any occasion, fully and completely, with nothing extra, that's really rare. And when you notice it in a person, you don't notice it right away like you do some super charismatic person, but if you hang around a person long enough, you start to notice that. And it's very palpable in their presence. Everything they do expresses that quality. It took me a while to notice that in Mel, but when I did notice, I found it really, really inspiring, and inspiration enough to last me a whole life. He didn't write any books. Isn't that great? Nowadays, you can't be a Zen teacher without writing at least one book. Everybody has to write a book. He didn't write any books. He actually tried to write a book, but he never quite got around to it. But after he passed, the book that he was writing on other people completed. And so there is a book of his teachings, this book, Seeing One Thing Through. And I'm gonna end my talk with a poem that he wrote. It's called Aged Plum Tree. I'm cutting down the old plum tree outside the Tassajara Monastery office. Aged plum tree, venerable old monk, pillar between heaven and earth, silent partner, offering shade and sweet fruit, sometimes noticed, sometimes not, a fixed presence, a background for our comings and goings. How many times have we walked by feeling your presence, barely aware of the subtle rustling of your green leaves, dancing with the fall breeze, waving at the passers-by for no one knows how many years. Now your time is up. You will no doubt be fired, wood, turning yourself over to ash. Will you remember you were once a tree? That you were once a tiny seed? Or that you were once our long ago silent friend on the green grass outside the Tassajara office? What will become of you? What will become of us? And where will we meet again? In the dream time of our imagination, we will be sitting and swaying in the spreading arms of your branches, getting drunk on your delicious fruit and giving voice to all the stories you couldn't tell. So long, old friend. So that's my little talk for tonight. Thank you for listening. Do we have a moment for you guys to bring something up? So I would love to hear from you and respond to things that you want to bring up. You don't have to ask me learned and impressive questions. You can just say whatever you feel like saying. And if I have anything to say in response, I will. Looks like we have a microphone that you can use to speak.
I was wondering, was your love of poetry inspired by him, or did it already come? Or did you already have a love of poetry?
I was already a poet when I met him. I met Mel in 1970, when I moved to Berkeley from Iowa City, Iowa, where I had spent 2 years in the Iowa Writers Workshop. Oh, okay. So I had been a poet before.
Yeah, so it was just a bonus that he liked poetry too.
Yeah, he wasn't, he actually didn't write poems much. He wrote them for ceremonies and once in a while. Mill actually had been a painter. Mm-hmm. He was, I don't know if you know who Clifford Still is, but Clifford Still was a pretty famous California painter, abstract painter. You can see Clifford Still's works in the SF MoMA. And Mill was a student of Clifford Still and made lots of really great paintings, large format paintings in that manner. But he just gave it up on a dime when he started practicing Zen. He just stopped painting. I don't think he ever painted again after that. Yeah. Here's something over here.
Thank you. Really inspiring. One of the things I loved about the talk that you shared just now is unfolding a feels like kind of a paradox that we do and don't need saints, or they do and don't play a certain role. I just wonder two things. One, if you feel paradox is also central in other ways to your spirituality. And if there's anything particularly you learned from your own teacher that's helped you on your path.
Mm-hmm.
Big question, I know.
Well, I've been thinking about this idea of paradox, because it seems to me that these things are not exactly paradoxes. Because it's not, I guess you could say it's a paradox, but in a way, to say, as I said in my talk, yes, we need people we can admire, we need exemplars. And on the other hand, there's a downside to that. If we hold them up so high and hold ourselves to their standards and try to be them, then it can be a negative thing. And we really have to honor ourselves. So you could say, well, that's a paradox, but it's not really a paradox. Something can be true in a way, very true in a way, and in another way not be true. So that's, I guess, on a linear level or a literal level, that is a paradox, but it's not really a paradox, right? Because nothing is 100% true. Things are true in some way that's very important and not true in another way that's very important. And I guess it's good to see both sides. That you said, what did I learn from Mel, that Sojin Roshi, that was important to me? That phrase, the other side, was something that he said all the time. Because he would say such and such and so, and then he would say, and the other side is, and then he would say the opposite, often. Because it's kind of like when you hold something to be absolutely true, we call that ideology. And then you're driven by ideology. And you lose track of yourself. You lose track of what's in front of you. But when you see that there's this side, and that may be very true and very valuable, but there's also this side, the same with people. You know, we might really disagree with someone, but there's always the other side. You know, they're also probably decent, and they also, maybe there's something about the very thing that we disagree with that we could agree with if we just reflected on it more. So seeing always the other side, I think, is a really important thing for wisdom and balance. Yeah. And you could call it a paradox, like I say, but I don't think it's really a paradox. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for the question. Yeah, I studied intensely with Mel for about, we lived in the Zen Center for about less than 10 years. And then I went to Tassajara. And then for many years when I was practicing with the San Francisco Zen Center temples, I didn't study with him so directly. But we always kept up our connection, and I always felt like I was a student at the Berkeley Zen Center, even though I was San Francisco Zen Center. The Berkeley Zen Center in those days did not have the opportunity for full-time residential practice. So if you wanted to do full-time residential practice, you had to go to San Francisco. So in a way, I probably imprinted on Mel's early teaching, and he developed a lot, right? His teaching developed a lot, and I probably missed most of that development. But our personal relationship continued till the end of his life, and so I was always in touch with him.
We have Dave Riddell online.
Oh.
Yeah.
Hi, Dave.
Hi, Norman. Thank you so much for your talk.
Interesting
that the notion of a saint at that interfaith gathering you described mm-hmm. seemed to span such a spectrum.
Yeah.
I mean, at the one extreme, of course, there was this Japanese teacher who was so strict and harsh that Westerners suffered under his tutelage and in one case at least died. Interesting that there's such a spectrum of, you know, what it is to be a saint. I mean, ranging from the Japanese teacher who was so difficult that Westerners in particular who went to study with him would suffer greatly and even in one case apparently died. And at the other extreme, the kind of thing that you describe about the selflessness of Mel is kind of amazing and somewhat resonates, I think, with what the rabbi said at the interfaith gathering about God's glory being everywhere and always new. But I'm just kind of wondering, as I understand it, your talk tonight sort of reflects the essence of what you said when your turn came at the interfaith meeting. And I'm just wondering, given this spectrum of ideas about what a saint was, what was the group discussion like after all of these different pictures of sainthood had been described?
Well, I can't really tell you that because I had to go and talk to Eric after that. Eric is over there online. I had a meeting with Eric at 9 o'clock, so I had to leave, and I don't know what the discussion was, but I don't think there was much discussion. I think that was pretty much the end of the meeting. I think that I didn't know this, but I found out later that they had another panel on that was about it's not saints are not a good idea. That was another panel. This panel was supposed to be saints are a good idea. I didn't know that when I there are those religious leaders who probably more or less said what I said myself tonight in my talk, that there's a downside to the saints, the practice. Thich Nhat Hanh has famously said, or maybe he didn't say this, but people say that he said it, that the Buddha in the coming era is the Sangha. And there is a lot of, in effect, that's what Brian Stevenson was saying too, that it's in the age of where we're really trying to understand in this world true equality and true respect for everyone, then maybe having a hierarchical setup where there's better and worse people and more admirable and less admirable people doesn't serve us so well. So we're de-emphasizing, I think, our heroes. And you know, in this era, also biographies are written about our great heroes, and then it turns out that they weren't so great. They had all kinds of problems that we didn't think about before. It is the age of cynicism about everyone. So we need some people who can be decent, and we can notice that. And try to emulate them. Yeah, there's May.
Thank you so much. I'm thinking, he reminds me of
And then that, I'm not sure if he says so or that people, basically there's one sentence about what he's saying. Basically said, 是万物为己者，圣人也, meaning if a person see everything himself or herself, it's a saint.
Hmm. Meaning see everything as themselves? Is that what you
basically mean? If we see everything is part of me.
Part of me. And
so
I
basically
I, yeah,
no matter
yeah.
you like this person or don't like this person,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It's and so so then I'm sure it's the Shitoxixian says so, or I think there's another phrase which is even more terse. It is basically said saint, it's just ordinary people.
Yeah.
Which just sounds like male, you know, and then
yeah.
Beautiful.
Well, one thing I didn't say in the talk that I meant to say was that a striking thing about that meeting was that everyone who spoke seemed to embody the saints they were talking about, and also the tradition from which they came. So the Hindu guy sounded like a Hindu, you know, and the Muslim guy sounded like a Muslim. And the people that they were talking about also sounded like Hindus or Muslims, and the rabbi like a rabbi. So I think that our particular lineage of Zen does, I think, emphasize the saintliness of the ordinary and the ordinariness of the saint.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's a particular gift that comes from, probably philosophically it comes from Dogen, but on a more personal and down-to-earth level, I think it comes from Suzuki Roshi. And I think that it was embodied by Mel. Also, it is embodied in a very similar way by Les. So that's our particular tradition. That's our particular way of manifesting what in other traditions might be more elevated.
Actually, before I came to United States, actually I thought a lot of United States is like a Dao, because you guys are living on your own way. So Mel, which is your teacher, to me is a Daoism.
I see. Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah, yeah. Well, that maybe
yeah.
that's why. Maybe that's where that style comes from Taoism.
Yeah,
yeah. Maybe. I think maybe we should finish. No. Time.
Yeah.
I think maybe time.
Yeah.
Because I have a long drive.
Awesome.
You can't believe how long it took me to get here. So.
Travis had a question.
Oh, Travis. Okay, last one. I'll be brief.
I'll be brief.
Okay.
How do you think about innocence as it relates to saintliness?
Yeah, I think that saints are innocent. Bodhisattvas are innocent in a good way. I think it's possible to be innocent and not innocent at the same time. I think that's possible to understand. You can understand that people are not always going to be polite and nice. People are going to do nasty things or crooked things. But I think it's possible to love them anyway and treat them as if that weren't so, even though you can see that. So in other words, innocent in a way, but not innocent at the same time. Because I think it's just like what I was saying before, you can be cynical.
Yeah.
Right? Sometimes somebody will say, I don't want him to take advantage of me. And then I think to myself, well, what's wrong with being taken advantage of sometimes? Right? Do we always have to not be ever taken advantage of? Maybe it's okay to be taken advantage of sometimes. So I would rather preserve my innocence and my loving spirit than never be taken advantage of. Right? If the cost of my loving spirit is sometimes I've taken advantage of. So what? Do I really care? Does it really matter? Yeah. That was longer than I thought I would respond. Thank you.
Thank you.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to kannondo.org. That's kannondo.org.